When I got there, I asked about her and they asked me to wait a moment in an empty hospital room. They would bring her right away. Now I was unsure whether she had really died, because the nurse did not wish me any condolences or anything like that. Then at some point the door opened and my grandma was pushed in. She had a cloth over her face and body. They threw it down and left me alone with her. I looked at her and still wondered whether she was really dead, because she seemed very much alive, even though her eyes were closed. At that moment the door opened and my mother came in with tear-filled eyes. "Unfortunately you're late." She couldn't wait any longer, but I was with her. It was half an hour ago. It was exactly the time that I had noticed my grandma in the car. At that moment she actually died. After a while my brother arrived, who had had to travel even more kilometers than me to get there. We took the time to stay with her for a while, and the hospital even allowed us to do so without any problems. My mother told us what had happened that morning and that gallstones had caused her death. She was able to sleep peacefully because the doctors had respected Grandma's wish not to be kept alive. I told my mother and brother about the experience in the car and still didn't understand my grandmother's haste. My brother asked what date it was and suddenly we understood her haste. It was the 3rd of October, the 10th anniversary of German reunification. There was a big celebration for this occasion in Dresden, the city where my grandmother was born and loved. Her favorite politician was supposed to give a speech at 10 o'clock, weeks before. She had confirmed how much she would like to be in Dresden that day, because reunification had great symbolic significance for my family. After the war, she had suffered greatly under the division of Germany, and later they even had to flee and leave their beloved homeland. Reunification was a bit of a healing for her. And now there was to be a celebration in Dresden. My grandma had to be there, that was clear. And since she didn't want to put herself through the journey anymore, she had probably thought of another plan to be in Dresden on time that day. Now we knew why my grandma died just before 10 and was in quite a hurry. She had waited for me as long as possible, but I was simply half an hour late. Her death couldn't have been more characteristic of her life. Her funeral was the first for me in a long time. After the many losses, the situation had actually calmed down after I had started to consciously confront the subject of death. Through the many conversations with my grandmother, we knew exactly what was important to her for this funeral. I was sad, but I understood where she had gone and that she was doing well. So I didn't feel any deep sadness, just a little sadness because my life would now go on without her. The situation was much more difficult for my mother, because she had lived with her in the same house for the last few years. Now the day of the funeral arrived, and it wouldn't have been my grandmother if she hadn't made herself known somehow. My mother, my brother and I were standing in front of the decorated coffin in the chapel when my brother asked me, "Is she actually here?" I looked around and told him that she was moving towards the small, wooden pulpit. I said jokingly, "Maybe she wants to give a speech." A moment later, the pulpit steps creaked loudly for all of us to hear, as if someone were climbing them. Then I saw her standing there and my mother just said, "Well, that's typical." Because when my grandmother was in the right mood, she could entertain entire halls with her dry manner, which she had done with great joy during her lifetime. In this way, she gave my mother and brother certainty and comfort that she actually still existed in another way, because they couldn't see her visually like I did. Since her death, she has come to visit me in my dreams from time to time. She is simply there, but doesn't say much. That's not necessary, because everything has been said between us. I love her and she will always be and remain a part of my life. And when it's my turn to go back to the spiritual world, I'll see her again anyway. There are two other companions that I absolutely have to mention in relation to my spiritual development. They are my two dogs, Lucky and Baloo. They found their way to my side when I was still married to my first husband Marcus and we lived in our idyllic little house on the mountain. They were probably our children. Today I am glad that I had these dogs before I had children, because I was able to learn a lot from the dogs before I threw myself into raising children. They taught me the merciless principle of mirroring, just as children do with their parents. These dogs brought things to light in me that I would never have suspected in myself before. They often tested my limits, and the first thing I learned was to act consistently, which is also known to be worth its weight in gold when raising children. Lucky and Bala raised me to be consistent and showed me that I had the strength to lead, something I would never have believed myself capable of before. They also took on important tasks in my work. Whenever people came to me in need of help, I observed the following: if a person was particularly depressed and hopeless, Bala would come, put his paw on the person's knee and offer comfort, which was surprisingly accepted even by people who were afraid of dogs. These dogs are very large in stature and doubly impressive because of their black fur. Bala's gesture seemed to me as if he wanted to say that everything would be okay. But when people came to me whose children had died, Lucky was ready shortly beforehand to greet them when they came through the door. To this day, I can tell from the way he greets people whether they have a deceased child or not. He then has a completely different look than usual and approaches them in a distinctive way. The age of the deceased child is not important. It can also be children who are still in the mother's womb. Body. He simply sees them and greets the parents on behalf of their child. This also applies to children who have not yet been conceived. As soon as a soul has decided on certain parents, he perceives them. I became aware of this when my dog sat in front of me every evening for weeks and fixed me with this special look. I asked my current husband if he had any idea what could be wrong with the dog. We were at a loss, but a few weeks later we got the answer: I became pregnant, and when I noticed it, my dog stopped looking at me in his peculiar way. Bala, on the other hand, helped me to pay more attention to my own needs. Whenever we were somewhere where I didn't feel comfortable and actually wanted to be somewhere else, it didn't take long before he vomited right at my feet. He showed me clearly that I didn't think it was a crap where I was. I learned to ask myself early on who or where I wanted to spend my time with and whether I really felt comfortable where I was. From that time on, Bala no longer had to vomit. These are just a few examples of everything I was able to learn from these wonderful creatures. Today, Lucky is the only one who still lives with us and still helps me when I work with people. At some point I will buy him a cap like the nurses used to have. Then he would finally have the right work clothes. Bala has since moved in with my mother. He decided this himself by simply not getting into the car one day when I wanted to drive home after visiting her. He made it clear to me that his job with me was over and that my mother needed him now. The last few months have shown how right he was with his decision. I would never have believed that dogs could help you develop so much as a human being. You just have to give them a chance and look in the mirror, which they represent in their own way. You don't have to humanize the animal or make it a substitute child. You just have to respect and value it as an equal part of creation. Then came the point where I happened to consciously see a person's aura for the first time. I was in a church with my ex-husband for some reason that day for a service. Despite our separation, we still had very good contact with each other, which has remained the case to this day. We sat on the pew and listened attentively to the priest's speech, the same one who had married us back then. Suddenly my ex-husband asked me if I could see the bright glow around the priest's head or if he had a problem with his eyes. I looked and saw it too. Although it was quite dark in the church, you could see a white glow around the man's head and shoulders with the naked eye while he was speaking. Then I remembered what I had learned in training with the English medium: people, or all living beings, are surrounded by an aura, also known as an energy field, which consists of different layers. One layer is white and shimmers through and is located relatively close to the body. During the seminar, I was the only one who had not been able to see the aura, and since then I have thought that this was not one of my talents. If I needed to know something about the aura, I had always asked my spiritual helper, and he would give me the information I needed. That is why I was all the more surprised when I was suddenly able to see the priest's energy field with no effort at all. During a later seminar with a healer, I finally got the crucial tip about how easy it is to see the aura. All you need is the daydreamer's look and you can see the aura. Unfortunately, no one explained this to me during my training. But as you can see, the knowledge that wants to reach you somehow reaches its destination. You can rely on that. I find it significant that we both had this experience in the very church in which we had been married a few years earlier. A topic that I had successfully avoided up to that point now made its way into my life. I was sitting at breakfast and listening to the radio. I only heard fragments of the report, which said that a 12-year-old child had been missing since yesterday. I registered it and went back to my normal daily schedule. To start my work, I went to my workshop. Somehow this report was still buzzing around in my head and wouldn't let me go. As I was walking the dogs at lunchtime, I suddenly heard a child's voice in my head. It said, "Hello, I'm the girl you heard about on the radio this morning. I need your help." I thought to myself, "Yes, definitely. You tell me the name of the perpetrator and I will call the police and they will arrest him." My sarcasm was unmistakable, because I was anything but happy that the deceased girl had contacted me. I had already had a similar experience when I was 16. At that time, a murdered child turned to me and wanted my help, but at that point I was too afraid of being sent to the nut house. And now another young person was standing in front of me and wanted my support. I asked her, not as sarcastically as at the beginning, what she thought I could do for her. She then explained to me in detail what had happened yesterday when she had disappeared. She showed me the daily routine in the form of an internal film, the routes she had taken and how she had met the perpetrator very close to the house where her family lived. At that moment I realized for the first time that the news hadn't mentioned anything about a crime. After all, it could have been that she had simply run away from home. She described the perpetrator to me in detail and I suddenly saw the crime through his eyes. I also sensed that he hadn't left home that morning with the intention of doing it. He also explained to me how the police could find him. He had already been convicted of a crime 10 years ago, but for minor car offenses. He was also suffering from the fact that he had done something to the child and wanted to be found. That's why I got all this information from him. Now I could no longer doubt, because when I turned on the radio the next morning, I heard the report that the child's body had been found not far from where they lived. It wasn't long before the child contacted me again. She said, "See, I told you. Will you help me now?" I said I was willing to do what I could for her. But I wanted to know why she didn't go to another medium. There were certainly lots of people who would be keen to do such jobs. She told me that was exactly the reason. She didn't need someone who wanted to make a name for themselves, but someone she liked and who she could trust. What else could I say to that? She seemed to like me a lot and there are no arguments for likability. The girl explained to me what I could do for her. I should give all the information to the police, which I dutifully did. I called the relevant police station rather naively and they assured me that they would follow up on the information. Somehow I sensed that the officer was laughing at me and wouldn't bother to check my information. He just said, "Send me everything again in writing by fax." I felt fobbed off and didn't understand how such information couldn't at least be checked. 2 days later, the girl came to me again and said that I had to do something. I should write a letter to her parents in which I would record everything again and ask them to ask the police whether these clues had been followed up. I told her very vehemently that I would definitely not write to her parents because that would be an incredible violation of boundaries and, besides, I didn't even know where she lived. She asked me again and again and assured me that her parents would not misunderstand me. I was torn. On the one hand, I wanted to help the girl, but on the other hand, I didn't want to pressure the child's parents or, worse, hurt them. I said to her, "Fine. If you can get me to your address, then I'll do it." I thought I was very clever because I was sure that the girl wouldn't succeed and I would be fine. In the evening, I watched TV and when the news came on, they reported on the latest developments in the murder case. Suddenly I heard her say, Now look closely and listen carefully. The street sign where the girl's parents' house was displayed so that I could read it in peace. In this context, the presenter also mentioned the name of the place where she had lived. Now she said, "You write to the parents of street and place, and I assure you that it will arrive." I had really underestimated the little lady, which has been a lesson to me to this day. If a deceased person really wants something, then he will manage to achieve his goal. So I sat down and started writing. I apologized for even writing to them and tried to briefly explain myself and my situation and to explain. I wrote that I had already sent the police a fax a few days ago and enclosed a copy of it with the letter. I also asked her to ask the police again what had happened with these extremely specific clues. Whether they had already been followed up on them, as in my opinion the officers were investigating in the wrong direction. Then the girl wanted me to write a few personal things for her mum. She wanted to apologize as she had been a bit grumpy with her mother recently and the girl was very sorry about that. She wanted me to write to her parents to say how much she loved them. I sealed the letter, stamped it and asked God to forgive me if what I was doing was a serious mistake and actually posted the letter at the post office. That was a Tuesday morning. 2 days later, when I was at my friend's house in the evening, the TV was on in the living room. I was standing alone in her kitchen when she called out excitedly, "Come quickly! They've got the perpetrator! Quickly!" I immediately ran into the living room and couldn't believe my eyes. That was exactly the man I had seen in my mind's eye. The police had suddenly changed their minds that morning and instead of looking in the sexual offense file, they had strangely included the file of offenders for minor car offenses in their investigations. And that was exactly where they had found the young man. In the later court hearing, this man testified about how exactly this crime had come about and that he was sorry for what had happened. He hadn't planned it. His statements really matched the information I had received and I don't need to say how astonished I was. To this day I don't know whether I was able to contribute anything to solving the case or whether it was all a coincidence. But for me it was a life-changing experience and a lesson in, rely on your perception. I am very grateful to the girl for being so persistent, because otherwise I would never have had this experience and would be a lot poorer. Over the next few weeks, it slowly dawned on me what God had planned for me, and I remembered my out-of-body experience when I saw the lights on the globe. It was as if a door to my future had opened for a brief moment, and I got a brief feeling of what was to come. I was overcome with fear and suddenly felt very small and unable to complete this task. I sat in the corner like a heap of misery and cried uncontrollably. I told my spiritual helper that I really wasn't asking for much. Just a completely normal life with a completely normal job. He made it clear to me that I would have to forget about that, because my path was different. I felt totally overwhelmed and left alone. How am I supposed to manage that? I asked him, not really knowing what kind of plan we were actually talking about. I had simply had a small foretaste in the form of a feeling, and that was enough for me. I could practically feel all the hopes that people would place in me, the expectations, the longings. I didn't want to know any more, because that was already a pretty large amount of information. I told my helper that I felt as if the angels had forgotten me here and simply left me behind on earth. I was filled with endless pain at parting. I had to be mistaken that I was destined for such tasks. He just said that I was by no means forgotten, on the contrary. I was in exactly the right place. I just had to bring the angels' help to earth and not believe that I was here without support. He said, "Bury your longing behind heaven, bring heaven to earth. You won't be alone for a moment, you just have to change your perspective. We need you, and it would be an honor for us if you would work with us and help us." My grief slowly subsided, and I felt that I was actually not alone. Suddenly I was certain that everything would only happen little by little anyway. I didn't have to rack my brains about everything I had to do. I would go step by step and grow with each task. I could accept everything that was still to come and was suddenly certain of this spiritual support. So I just said, "Okay, I'm ready to fulfill my plan, without even knowing it exactly. This experience changed me a lot. Since then, I have become more serious, but also more relaxed. I don't think so much anymore, but let a lot more happen. After this experience was the first time that television approached me. To this day, I don't know how they found me, as I didn't have a website or do any other advertising at the time. The chapter of my public relations work began, and luckily I had no idea what that would mean for my life in concrete terms, otherwise I would have backed out. This request from television was about a child who had been murdered years ago, and they were still looking for the perpetrator. They wanted to try to find out more about the murder with the help of people with my talent. Until the show started filming, I only knew that it was a crime. Who, what or how was unknown to me. I didn't know who the second medium would be either. The idea of the show was to find out more about the crime and the circumstances in an unconventional way. They also wanted to test whether people with mediumistic talent would independently come to the same conclusions and conclusions. I found this idea very interesting for several reasons. On the one hand, I could perhaps use my talent to help shed more light on this case, which could potentially help the police, and the parents, in their investigations. On the other hand, I knew that media could independently come to the same conclusions. However, since I had never tested this myself with someone in such a concrete and verifiable situation, I was naturally very curious to see how I would handle this matter. So I flew to Berlin without knowing my final destination. I was picked up there and taken to a hotel. The next morning, the show's team drove me to Eastern Germany, and I had no idea where I was, as I was visiting this part of Germany for the first time in my life. We started filming in a high-rise housing estate, and the production manager gave me a photo of a child of about 10 years old. He told me her first name, and then it was my turn. I sensed the deceased girl, and she told me a lot about herself, her hobbies, and her family. She explained to me that she had lived in the high-rise building at number 6. There, a lady looked down from the balcony and she greeted her with, "Hello, Mrs. Muller." I went to the entrance of the building and there, on the doorbell of the floor where the balcony was the name Muller. I was really amazed and it continued like that all day. She showed me what had happened on the day she disappeared and also a lot of details about the perpetrators and the course of events. She also told me what she had liked when she was alive and who her role models had been. The TV team was just as impressed by the information as I was, because they knew that I had not received any background information about the case from them beforehand. They treated the second medium in exactly the same way as they had treated me, and when the program was broadcast, I finally found out how identical our statements were. It was only then that I discovered who the other medium was with whom they had carried out the same tests as with me. They had kept us in the dark about everything until the end, but that had been agreed beforehand. I had only been told that they were satisfied with the results of the recordings. I was all the more pleasantly surprised when I saw how well we had worked independently as interpreters for the deceased girl. Even the police made a statement in the film about how they assessed these very specific results. Unfortunately, I don't know how far the investigations have progressed or whether they have perhaps even been completed. But for me it was a great experience and of course also a confirmation that these contacts with the deceased really work. And so my confidence in my work and my perceptions were strengthened once again. I also noticed how much fun I had working with television and how well I could combine the technical processes behind the camera with my perception. It didn't bother me when someone said, "Can you repeat that?" or interrupted me during contact with the deceased because the tape had to be changed. I can work very well under these conditions and it gives me a lot of pleasure. I'm not really that interested in how the whole thing ends up looking on TV. For me, it's just important that the team I work with respects contact with the deceased and takes this connection to the spiritual world seriously. It's no problem at all if someone personally has a different opinion on this topic. The producer of this show later explained to me that it was not a given that our collaboration was so straightforward. Most people with mediumistic talent set a lot of conditions before they dare to work with television. I felt that this experience with television would not be my last. I knew that this topic would come up again in my life, although I had no idea how, where and when that would be. My motivation was simply the fun of it and the opportunity to help people in this way. I continued with my work as before, and because of the broadcast of this show, offers from television came in now and again. However, I turned them down because I didn't like the ideas of the formats or they didn't match my motivation to help people. In the meantime, I had developed my own ideas for a show and preferred to wait until I found the right people for it. I wasn't interested in being on television at any price, but rather in how I could provide the greatest service to the spiritual world. In the meantime, more and more people came to me and I had a lot to do. Now the moment came when I decided to give up my old job as a goldsmith for good. I had only spent a few days in my workshop last year and realized that the time had come to make a decision. So I held a farewell exhibition and sold my entire workshop equipment, apart from a box of my favorite tools. It all happened by itself and that surprised me again, because experience has shown that it is not easy to sell a goldsmith's workshop. But within 2 weeks everything was sold. That confirmed my decision not to work as a goldsmith in the future. I was now officially working as a medium and was no longer ashamed of it. It had become my purpose in life to support people as best I could with my talent. I was even proud of my brave step of finally being there for people full-time and officially. Painting remained a hobby for me, but I was no longer a goldsmith, and I have never regretted it to this day. Even though I really enjoyed this profession and did it with all my heart over the years. Now my so-called wave dreams began. I had the first dream a few weeks before I was asked if I would be a guest on a very good talk show hosted by a pastor. I was offered the opportunity to do a show with me about death and the spiritual world. It was an offer that suited me and I knew that this topic would be treated respectfully. So I said yes. And after the show was broadcast, I finally understood what my wave dream had to do with this public relations work. This dream showed me weeks before in a very symbolic way what would come my way after this show, a huge wave of requests for help from people who were grieving for someone. In the dream, it was a huge wave that built up in front of me and remained piled up until I was at a safe distance and could watch in peace and amazement as it crashed down. I would never have expected that this broadcast could have such an effect. With this broadcast, I simply wanted to show people the door to the spiritual world and explain that life continues after death. The reactions to this broadcast were so immense that, with the help of some friends, I spent the next 2 years processing the requests and developing a sensible system for how I could satisfy people's incredibly great interest in this topic. Because I had to and wanted to do all of this without the quality of my work suffering. That was a big challenge for me, because I couldn't be there for everyone at the same time. I had to learn that I couldn't help everyone directly, and that was initially a difficult situation for me to bear. I became aware once again of how important boundaries are and that I needed them more urgently than ever before. Because if I were to exhaust myself completely and then collapse at some point, it would ultimately not help anyone. So I had to make sure that I did not forget myself and still did my best to fulfill my task. During this time, it was also very impressive for me to see how great people's longing for hope and faith is. I experienced again and again that it was often enough to offer comfort and hold them for a little while. It became more than clear to me. N showed how lonely most people feel. Even though it would be so easy to be there for each other, genuine interest in other people and, above all, love for them have become a rare commodity. And so this also became a conscious motivation for my task, to remind people how easy it is to love and to be there for each other again without forgetting or even giving up on yourself. My unplanned but desired pregnancy ultimately contributed to the fact that I did not work myself to death. I was forced to slow down and take the life to come into consideration, which was not particularly difficult for me. Today I realize that this child announced its arrival 6 months after the talk show was broadcast and settled in me so that I did not overdo it. I am very happy that everything turned out exactly as it did.